living the whole gospel the whole way, living a whole life the whole way. And here we have Jesus in Matthew 22 helping us see what that can and should look like. Would you look at the text with me? When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they came together. And one of them, an expert in the law, asked a question to test him. "Teacher, which command in the law is the greatest?" He, Jesus, said to him, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and most important command. The second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets depend on these two commands." May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. I confess to you that I have always been a rule follower, mostly because I really like the benefits that come with being a rule follower. In eighth grade, I remember distinctly, and I was a pretty good student along the way, it was important to me to make good grades, much more important to make good grades than actually learn the material. So I did a lot of cramming and memorization that went away immediately after the test, which makes no sense. I guess all the kids are gone now, so I'm just talking to nobody. Anyway, one day I left my assignment book in my locker before I went to my whatever period it was, and we had to turn in our assignment books that day for a grade, and I didn't have mine with me, but it was 30 feet away at my locker, but my teacher to teach me a lesson did not allow me to go get it because I had failed to bring it with me, and so I got a zero for that assignment, which left me with a much lower grade for the semester than I wanted, and I was distraught because I'm a rule follower, and I like the benefits that come from following rules. Somewhere in my core is this desire to please others. I have lived with this my whole life because I want you to like me. I want you to be comfortable with my existence. And that I don't know if it's good or bad. It's where I am. What's at your center? Are you a rule follower? Rule maker? Are you a list maker? All the Enneagram ones out there, raise your hand as list makers. I have a friend who is an Enneagram one, and he's a list maker extraordinaire. And he will, if he accomplishes a task that was not on his list, you know it's coming. He will go back and write it on his list just so he can check it off, even though it's done. I don't do that, but he does. So if you resonate with that, or you know someone who does, if you're a list maker or know a list maker, you probably would be pretty quick to be able to write down your priorities on a list. Be able to set down a list of priorities that describe your life. And so one question I would ask us all today is, where is God on our list of priorities? Now, I think at 11:05 on Sunday morning while you're sitting at church, you'll probably say God's at the top of that list. But I'm asking you to introspectively search your soul, seek your center, and where is God really on your list? I recall my formative years. I'm still in my formative years, but I still being formed. All of us are. But I remember back in college, I had a chance to spend, I'm going to name drop here, but I had a chance to spend quite a bit of time with David Platt. And I remember one night we're at summer camp and he's teaching all of these children such wonderful truths of the gospel. And we started talking about making lists and priorities. And he recalled somebody that taught him about priorities, that God should not, in fact, be on our list of priorities. I was shocked to hear David say that. And the lesson he had learned was that God should actually be the paper on which we write our priorities. Ha ha. It's a pretty good word, though, that God is not simply on our list, but God is the list. God is our why, our center, as we've talked about the last few weeks, our true north, that which our compass directs us to and with is Jesus, whom we should base all of our priorities on. And one of the things that Jesus is doing here in the text is he's helping to clarify what our center should be. And from our center flows our priorities. And one of the ways we can tell what our center is we look at what rules govern our lives, what rules we live by. I Googled the 7 cardinal rules for life, because everything on the internet is true. They're pretty good. Make peace with your past so it won't disturb your present. What others think of you is none of your business. I like that. Time heals almost everything. Give it time. No one is in charge of your happiness except you. Don't compare your life to others. Stop thinking too much. The last one I particularly like, smile. I live by a few rules myself. I drink a glass of milk every night before I go to bed, just like a toddler. I try to exercise daily. I try to look people in the eye, because my mother taught me to do that. I try to put myself in your shoes, no matter where you're standing. And the things that undergird those things that I live by, as I pray, I read God's word, and I spend time with other people who do, particularly you. Our center is our true north. It's Jesus. And it's the difference that deciding to follow Jesus makes that forms what makes up our center. One more thing that's on my list that I think is important for us today before we dive back into this passage is I try to remain curious. Here's what I mean. I'm a lifelong learner, at least I want to be. Because when we believe that the kingdom is coming and has already begun, then we must believe that God is still forming us, as I said, forming things, revealing God's self in the world. God is still, in this sense, creating. And we are called to be part of that by first being open to what God is calling us to do. If you follow Jesus, those rules which govern your life, that list which you would make as your priorities for each and every day, it must be birthed out of what God's will is for your life and for the world. I've probably said this to you before, but one of my favorite theologians, Christopher Wright, he distinguishes between, or he tries to get us to think about God's will in this way, not as what God has prepared for you to do specifically in the world, but rather what kind of you God desires for God's mission that is already going forward in the world. That's an important distinction there for us today. And in a sense, this list of rules that I live out of is how I try to live out Jesus' commands, Jesus' will for God's mission in the world and how God might be forming me, forming us to be a part of that, all the while realizing that God's still forming me, God's still forming us. There was one of those songs that formed me that I remember from my youth, God ain't through working on me yet, or us, or this world. This story has stuck with me and always will, but N.T. Wright was writing his, I don't know what number, book about Jesus, and his wife very calmly and matter-of-factly said, Tom, why are you writing another book about Jesus? Haven't you already done that? Has Jesus changed? And he looked at her and said, well, no, but I have. So this morning I ask you if you're drawn to want to do things the right way and to continue to do things the right way. One of my favorite podcasts I listen to each week, it's about a woman named Emily P. Freeman. It's called The Next Right Thing, and it's fabulous. And she just tunes our attention, tries to, for about 12 minutes, to what it looks like to tune our hearts and minds in the direction of doing the next right thing, because we have this desire to do things the right way. That's what's going on in this passage. There were many Jewish rabbis in this day that here in Matthew when Jesus was alive and ministering on earth, and their life's work was to help explain Torah to God's people. Now, they knew that Torah sometimes referred to literally the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. But in other senses, Torah referred to the whole of the Hebrew teaching, all of the Old Testament. In essence, it was the totality of Hebrew teaching and the call on one's life in light of this teaching. There were 613 commandments that made up Torah. To live by the commandments was to know the scriptures and then live them out. Rabbis would have apprentices, people who would follow them and study under them. These folks were called Talmudim. They would literally memorize the Pentateuch. Think about that. My 11-year-old told me this week he hates reading. It's so boring. Shoot. They would read so much that they would have the Pentateuch memorized because that is how they would prove their worth, their worthiness to study under the rabbis. Son, how many birds are mentioned in Numbers? And in a few seconds, he would come up with it. Because he didn't just have it memorized where he could call the words. He had it committed to his being. Like those songs form us, shape us. Torah formed these apprentices, this Talmudim. Son, tell me all about Joseph's life from birth to death. And he could rattle it off immediately. And after knowing Torah, a deeper level of knowing would be sought. And that would be application. What do you do with all these birds that are mentioned? What does Joseph's life teach us about how God would have us live? And the application of the 613 commandments would go forth. But the problem was, at times, these commandments would contradict one another, at least in a literal sense. Because you're supposed to help your neighbor when their donkey falls in a hole. But when it happens on Sabbath and you're not supposed to lift a finger on the Sabbath, you have yourself a conundrum right there. What do we do? Or sometimes you're walking to Jerusalem and you pass by someone who looks to be dead, right? And they're so beaten up because they were robbed and beaten that they may be dead. And you're a priest and you're not allowed to touch someone else's blood because of the call on your life to do what God has assigned you to do. So if that someone who's dead, their blood. So if that person is dead, you can't touch them. So you don't walk across the road to see because they may be dead. And so you walk by and you appear heartless, but you're really just trying to follow that commandment. So you see how sometimes these commandments can, in a sense, contradict one another. So the rabbis, they had these bends in the way that they understood Torah and taught it. And they would rank commandments. They would assign importance to some more than others so people would know what to do when situations like this arose. The Pharisee in the story is trying to get Jesus to reveal his rankings. And in doing so, he's trying to trap him and expose him. This story is also in Luke and Mark, but in Matthew, it's set up a little bit differently where the apparent motives of the Pharisee are exposed as someone who's trying to trap Jesus, to hurt him. But Jesus answers, and in doing so, he boils down the 613 commandments to two, and I would argue one, but he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and most important command. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets depend on these two commands. I've been taught, scholars teach, that the second is like it when Jesus says that. He's not saying 1A, 1B. He's not saying 1, 2. He's saying this is just as important as that. And I believe that. All the law and the prophets, Jesus referring to that, references that the whole of Jewish teaching is founded on and builds from these, what he says here. Love God, love people. Some of us want certainty. The expert in the law here wanted certainty. He wanted Jesus to deduce exactly how he should live and put the law in its proper context. We want to feel like our way is the right way. I get it. But if we are not careful, we will shut out people who challenge us in a lovely way. People that may be in our lives as humble counselors, people who are lifelong learners, teachers and accountability partners that do point us first toward loving God and loving others, because it has happened in the church too often that we have been so focused on being correct about what the laws are and what they mean and how they should influence our lives that we have failed to do what Jesus is telling us to do first. I ask you today if you fall into that category. I certainly have at times in my life. I didn't have many friends in high school because I was so busy telling those who could be my friends what they should live like. When he was 20 years old, Dr. Fred Craddock read Dr. Albert Schweitzer's book, The Quest for the Historical Jesus. Dr. Craddock said that as a young theology student reading the book, he had lots of questions that he realized smacked of sophomoric enthusiasm and youthful arrogance. He questioned Schweitzer's Christology, and as he read through this book, he marked it up, crossing out whole paragraphs and putting huge question marks on some pages in the margins. Craddock later said that he was extremely critical and harsh in his judgments of Schweitzer's writing. And not long after he read the book, Dr. Schweitzer came to visit Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Craddock was pastoring in Knoxville at the time, and so he took a bus up to see Dr. Schweitzer in Cleveland at this church where he came to present an organ concert at this church. Schweitzer was a philosopher, theologian, medical doctor, pastor, and world-class organist. His list of priorities was long. So Craddock went up to see him, and on the whole bus trip up there, he had Dr. Schweitzer's book out. He was going over his notes again. He was writing down questions to ask Dr. Schweitzer. He was going to really interrogate him and hold his feet to the fire. And by all of his questions, he wrote down the page references so that when he asked the question, he could reference the exact page that the question was founded on, saying, on page so-and-so, Dr. Schweitzer, you said this, and I don't believe it. And on page so-and-so, you said this, and this contradicts the other. And he was ready, and he was going to straighten out Albert Schweitzer. Craddock made it to Cleveland. He went to the concert and was mesmerized by Schweitzer's brilliant performance on this new beautiful church organ. And when the concert was over, Fred Craddock ran to the fellowship hall and sat down in the front row because the invitation had said that there would be a time for question and answer and snacks afterward, and he was going to be right there in the front row ready to ask his questions. It took a while for Dr. Schweitzer to walk in. He had shaggy hair and a big mustache, and he was stooped over, 75 years old at the time. He was carrying a little cup of tea and a small plate with some goodies on it. And Schweitzer walked to the microphone in the front of the room and said, "You have been so good to me, church, so hospitable, and I have so enjoyed my time here. But I cannot stay any longer. You see, I operate a small medical clinic down in Gabon in Africa, and my people are there, and my people are dying, and my people are hungry, and my people are diseased, and I need to go back. And if any of you have the love of Jesus in you, would you consider coming with me?" Dr. Craddock said in that moment, he looked at his questions in his lap and realized that they were all utterly stupid. He said, "In that moment, I was changed. I knew then what it was to be a Christian, and I hoped someday I would be one." Jesus took this man's question about certainty and about process and about rules that was designed to trip Jesus up. And he answered it. And he clarified it. And he showed us what is of first importance, what is of utmost importance. He is asking us by answering this question in this way, if we will follow him, if we will serve alongside him, if we will help take care of those who need help being taken care of. And I believe Jesus' life and ministry, as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John record it, explain this very well. We would do better as the church to read the Gospels more. I would do better as your pastor to read the Gospels more often and to see how Jesus lives this out, because it is there. And the call for us to help serve alongside Jesus, to care for those who have more trouble than us taking care of themselves is all over those pages. So in this vision series of living a whole life the whole way, that's what undergirds what our calling is as the church at Harpeth Heights. And in, you know, sweet Baptist preacher form, it's alliterative and can be boiled down to three words that begin with a G. First is gospel. My buddy Wade Owens likes to say gospel first, gospel always. I like it when he says it because it reminds me of the truth of our mission statement. We are here to engage the whole person with the whole gospel of Jesus Christ, anytime, anywhere, with anybody. And that believing the gospel with all of our being would result in gospel conversations. And that these gospel conversations will become gospel relationships. You know, gospel is not just good advice, Tim Keller reminds us. It's good news. And if it's not good news for everybody, then it is not, in fact, good news for anybody. And Jesus, if he is not Lord of all, he is not Lord at all. So I remind you again, you have not ever looked in the eyes of someone who is not loved by Jesus and who is not worthy of your time, attention, eye contact, and care, to perhaps be open to what a gospel conversation with that person could look like. Next, we're going to be in groups. We already are. So many of you are so faithful to your groups, and you're being fed by them and you're feeding into them, because groups exist for two reasons: for accountability and for equipping. And we are going to be accountable to one another, and we are going to be accountable for one another, as Mike reminded us last week in our simulcasted video. Accountability and equipping. Accountability and equipping. And last, we're going to go. We're going to go because as we sung in Come Thou Fount, in that last beautiful verse that we sang, we are people who are never alone. And so we can go confidently into the world wherever that might take us with the gospel, expecting for God to do great things through the church at Harpeth Heights. And yes, that will be down the street in a variety of ways. That will be across the state to Rogersville this Christmas, and I hope you'll consider going with us as we go there. And that will be to the ends of the earth, wherever that may take us. We are going to follow God to take the gospel wherever God would have us to take it. Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. And we do all this because of what Jesus is getting at here. Too often, our obedience is to get God's attention, to get God to love us, to satisfy God. The same reasons I've been a rule follower my whole life is because I like the reward that comes with being a rule follower. But that is not what the gospel teaches. Obedience to Jesus, to live out loving the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind, and to loving your neighbor as yourself. And then all that flows from that is not to get Jesus, to be proud of you or to love you or to notice you. That has been done. You can't do anything to make God love you more or love you less. You are obedient to what God calls you to do. I am obedient to what God is calling me to do because of what God has already done. Jesus loves you in spite of your brokenness. So you can go serve him confidently, expecting God to use you, because it is not your power that God is using. You can't do anything to make God love you more. Your obedience flows out of how much God already loves you, and he has shown us that in his Son, Jesus Christ, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but rather took on the nature of a servant and died a sinner's death, the worst death, on a cross, because he loves you. And the intent there was for you to never have to die. And you won't if you follow him. Let's pray.